Welcome back, folks. We're going to jump into what's happening in Sparrows Point, what's happening to steel workers here in the city of Baltimore, and really it's a reflection of what's happening around the country. And we have a lot of guests with us, many of them steel workers. Another one, a journalist who is covering this, as well as somebody who works in the other side of the steel industry, which is investing in steel and monitoring the steel industry. Let me begin by just saying that you know, when you look at this, this is an issue that really kind of strikes home for many people in this community. This is a city that had 50,000, 60,000 steel workers, down to 2,000 at Sparrows Point, all of whom were about to lose their jobs. Then it's not a minor issue. Man, there was, the steel hall was filled with people last night who wanted to ask questions and learn about this. I mean, just think about where we've come in America before we introduce our guest. Think about where we've come. You know, in the last 25 years, 1.5 million steel workers have lost their jobs. 1.5 million steel workers have lost their jobs. Steel workers have lost their benefits. Just hundreds of thousands laid off at one time, not laid off, but have lost their benefits at in one fell swoop. Between 2002 and 2003, 200,000 steel company retirees and all the dependents lost their health coverage from LTV Corporation and from Bethlehem Steel. So, and now we're seeing kind of things happening here in Baltimore once again in our storied industry. So we're joined here this hour by a number of men who have worked in those steel plants, people who are covering this issue. I want you to join us here, 410-319-8888. Joe Rozelle is with us. Joe is president of the United Steelworkers Local 9477. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Thank you.
Mike Hartnett.
Yes.
Is with us. He is a laid-off worker from Sparrows Point. Mike, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Mike Lewis, financial secretary of United Steelworkers Local as well. Mike, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Mark Reuters with us once again, a reporter for Baltimore Brew, who's written books and articles about this for a long time. Mark, good to have you back here with us.
Pleasure.
Later we'll be joined by Charles Bradford, who's president of Bradford Research, and he's a steel industry analyst, to look at where the steel industry is going. You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. So let's talk a bit about what happened here. I mean, we had in August, steel workers in Baltimore, in Sparrows Point, are going to have the last of their benefits. They'll be gone. Right?
Right.
Joe?
Yes.
So talk a bit about, I mean, what has happened here. And I mean, you know, the steelworkers all came to the union hall last night, a lot of them.
Right.
Hundreds of them, trying to figure out what's going on and get answers. So talk about what happened last night and what you said to them.
Well, I mean, it was like two parts. I mean, the first part was to talk about what the future is going to be like. I mean, I said it was ironic that it was, you know, we're kind of celebrating the War of 1812 with the British, and now we're in the War of 2012. You know, the Battle of North Point has now become the Battle of Sparrows Point, that we need to fight for our future, and that's what we have to do. Yeah, it's bad. I mean, this company, RG Steel, went bankrupt. There was a bankruptcy proceeding that was an expedited bankruptcy proceeding that only lasted about 60 days. Those 60 days didn't seem to be enough for us to get what we really need as a solution, which is we need a strategic steelmaker to buy Sparrows Point, who's been in the business a while, has money, has raw materials, and can run Sparrows Point in a way that we can make money in good times and bad. Because it's been proven over time we can't run with just a financial owner. Because it's not just about how much it costs to buy the plant. It's the hundreds of millions of dollars in working capital you have to spend to start the plant back up again. And the fact that, you know, we could really use some CapEx, meaning some money put into the plant to upgrade, you know, plant and equipment, you know, that would make us more competitive, you know, in the future. But, I mean, there are plans that have been done through this process that show that that can be done.
And that's a big part of the issue. And I'm just curious, let me go around the room real fast. I'm curious, Joe, how long would you work in the steel mills? How many years?
34.
And Mike?
36 years.
36 years. And the other Mike?
34 years.
So you gentlemen, over three decades each. I mean, this is like almost 100 years worth of working in the steel mills between you all.
But it's more than that in the sense I'm third generation with people in my family working there for about 100 years. And Mike's
I'm fourth
and his daughter's in there for fifth.
Daughter's fifth generation.
And she's losing her job too.
That's correct.
And my granddad and my great uncle, when they came to Maryland from North Carolina in 1927, they started working at Sparrows Point.
Right. And it and when you were still worker in America, you're still worker here in Baltimore, in Dundalk, in Turner Station, wherever you lived, in Sparrows Point. I mean, this was what partially built the middle class of this nation.
Exactly.
So there's no doubt that probably for all of us, you know, it was good middle class jobs for my grandfather and, you know, my great uncle. My uncles, you know, allowed you to go to college. I got a bachelor's degree from Towson. But even people here at Morgan, a lot of minorities were able to get jobs at Sparrows Point, making enough money to send their kids that maybe they're engineers and doctors and nurses now from the money they made working in a steel mill. In fact, Elijah Cummings told me that he, you know, worked in this Sparrows Point steel mill for a while. So it was good-paying middle-class jobs that allowed you to achieve the American dream and make your next generation better than you were.
So I just want to kind of turn to the two mics for a second. And let me turn to first to Mike Hartnett, then go over to Mike Lewis. I mean, talk about what you're going through now. I mean, this is not a small deal. I mean, you're talking about your daughter losing her job. You're losing your job. And you're not going to and how to find a job that pays the wages they paid and had the benefits they had.
Well, I mean, you're correct. In 36 years in the mill, I don't even know how to look for another job. I'm the fourth generation, daughter being the fifth generation. Where do I go? I don't even know how to look for a job, like I just said. It's devastating. At this point in time, we're still kind of in a state of shock. What do we do next? How do we go about this? Daughter being younger than me, she may have a better chance at finding something out there. But my particular position is, you know, benefits. I mean, you're talking about a group of people at Sparrows Point that I've worked with over the last 36 years. That workforce is, to me, is second to none. We have a workforce that is, if someone was to come in and want to run this entity, I mean, this place could make money for you. We have the workforce. We have the people that are ready to do it. But to answer your question even better, it's like I think everybody is in a state of shock, especially the ones that have children. What about our health care? What are we going to do with this? This is
because you're about to lose your health care.
Yeah, that's correct.
And Mike Lewis.
Well, just to piggyback on what Mike said, one of the biggest concerns we have is benefits. I had a conversation with my wife last night who has a job that offers health insurance, but whereas we had no out-of-pocket contribution to our health insurance plan, we're going to have to incur at least a $500 a month bill now for husband and wife on the insurance coverage that she has at a time when we are newly unemployed. So for all of the people that don't think we need health care reform, not to get off, this should hit home for a lot of people. And also, Mark, working in the steel industry, as Joe and Mike has mentioned, has been a path toward upward mobility. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I mean, I'm an African-American from East Baltimore. I dropped out of college after my first semester, and I took a job at Sparrows Point at 18. I was hired as a laborer. Okay, during my course down there, I learned several skills. I became a union rep. I became an OSHA training instructor, you know, and I became a financial secretary. I know other people.
Of the local union.
And I know other people that took a path into management, from the shop floor into sales, into engineering. That plant provided a ladder of upward mobility, and a lot of people helped achieve the American dream. And what's missing to me today is the fact that we haven't taken into account the total social effect of the deindustrialization of America. When plants like Sparrows Point close and nothing comes in to replace it of equal or greater value.
And Mark Reuter, you've been covering this for a long time.
I have.
And wrote a book about it.
I have.
So, I mean, this is you know, we've seen the plant being whittled down, but this is almost unprecedented in the sense the idea that it's not just people being laid off, which is bad enough. We're seeing some people arguing the end of it.
Right. My book is really about the rise of Sparrows Point and how it rose from the 1880s out of the meadows and swamps of Sparrows Point. They had to drain the peninsula and things like that. It was developed by some of the biggest powerful entities then in the country, the Pennsylvania Railroad and the Baldwin Locomotive Works. And then it became operated, owned by Bethlehem Steel for a long, long time, as these gentlemen know and thousands in Baltimore know. And the last 10 years, really the last 20 years, has been, you know, a cycle of cutbacks. coupled with lack of investment at the plant, and that's sort of the root cause now of why it's been losing so much money and why it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, looking at the record, looking at it as a journalist looks at it, to ever have it return.
I mean, that's part of the question here. Go ahead, Joe. You're about to say something?
Well, I mean, I completely disagree with that. I mean, if you're a journalist, I guess you can look at it that way. When I'm in the plant and I look at it and people say, oh, well, you know, the plant's obsolete or the equipment's obsolete. The blast furnace is one of the best blast furnaces in the country. It's only three of them like it in the country. The other two are some of the best plants, U.S. Gary and Inland. So this blast furnace is one of the best, you know, in the country and probably one of the top 10 in the world. The coal mill's one of the best coal mills in the United States. The number four hot dip coating line is one of the best coating lines in the United States, does both galvanized and galvalume. The tin mill, while being older, we've never had complaints from companies that are high demand in terms of the quality, like Crown Cork and Seal, B-Way, and Silgan. They like our tin. They probably like us to get back into the market to do that. I mean, the hot mill's a little marginal. It was modernized in 91. But steel making, we have one of the best casters in the world. It's one, and especially in the United States, it's wide and thick. So it can make slabs that are especially good for plate mills and things of that nature. So there's a lot of good pieces, you know, in the plant. Investment could be made to make things better, like ladle met furnaces and vacuum degassing, which would be the biggest investment in steel making that would make it more competitive. But it's a deep water port, which means you can bring in raw materials cheaper. And there's always cycles in the steel industry that are up and down based upon the economy. And the ups and downs of Sparrows Point hasn't been the last 20 years. It's been like the last 30 years or more. I've been in every negotiation since 86. I was hired in 78, and the first troubles began in the early 80s. So that was 30 years ago that we had troubles in 83 and 86. It got better in 89, was okay in 93, you know, to 99 was okay, but at the end of that, like late 98. So it's all been these ups and downs over the 30 years.
But what I mean, but I mean, I think one of the issues here are the kind of changes that have taken place. I mean, it's like when you started 30 some years ago, there were a lot more men and women working on the floor, mostly men, but a lot more people working on in the plant. I mean, we've lost tens of thousands of jobs in this town in the steel mill. I mean, how many? We have 2,000 left.
But
one of the arguments is I've heard from other people, and this is, go ahead, Mike, is that if the steel plant does come in, maybe they'll have a quarter of those jobs. If they come in.
But you know, Mark, as Joe will tell you this, that our labor costs are 8% of the cost to operate the plant. We are one of the most cost competitive and efficient operations anywhere. There's just been a perception, I believe, amongst these managerial types that you squeeze labor for everything you can get out of them. You know, I mean, let's face it. The first thing they want to cut is jobs. We're very productive. We won't go back to that labor-intensive day of the early 60s when we had 33,000 people at the point. No operation can work like that in the United States. However, in China, they have 33,000 people working in their steel mills, you know, because they are doing what we did in the 60s. They're very labor-intensive. They don't pay very well, and they have their own set of issues. But as far as the productivity of the American worker, it's never been better. And anybody will tell you that.
So what you're about to say to me, Mark? Well, let me go to the phone to see what our listeners are thinking. 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. We want to hear the thoughts of maybe some of the men and women who work there, your questions and ideas, your points of view. 410-319-8888. Clarence in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Mr. Steiner, and to your guests.
Welcome.
First, I'd like to ask a question. As far as how Annapolis is looking at you at Sparrows Point, how do you feel Annapolis looks at the situation at Sparrows Point? Do they look at it as we have no solution to that problem, so, hey, there's nothing, as if they don't care? Or do you see anything in the future as a reach out? Because me being a technician all my life, and by the way, I worked at Coppers Corporation for a lot of years when the piston rink, when a lot of pistons ring came, those plates came from Sparrows Point through Coppers Corporation. So, you know, I know the impact of jobs that anything that affects Sparrows Point would have on jobs. But if you're shipping windmill towers throughout our state from somewhere else, then I feel like those parts should be stamped out here. And Annapolis has a big role in getting union together and getting buyers and other people involved in this to ensure that that plant stays open. I mean, that's something that this is a Stars Point is a state resource, and it should be looked at by people in Annapolis as a state resource and not just another business that can fly away or exist or not exist. Even I made a suggestion to someone when we bought the tower, the cranes, for to facilitate when the Panama Canal gets widened and we're going to need those bigger cranes down there. I mean, why couldn't Annapolis say, hey, we'll stamp those parts out here and we'll assemble them here instead of buying them somewhere else? Union, Annapolis, and everybody else could have came to the table and said, yeah, we're going to make this work to keep people working. So that's just my feelings, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence. Let's jump into this for a minute. And now let me introduce our other guest who just called in, Charles Bradford, who's president of Bradford Research and a steel industry analyst. Charles, welcome. Good to have you with us. And John in Dundalk gives a holler back, and the others calling in from Dundalk. We want to hear what you have to say. 410-319-8888. We'll go to Albert in Parkville next. We want to hear what you have to say. But one of the things that Clarence was saying, I mean, that's real. I mean, we haven't heard a peep out of Kevin Kamenetz, out of the county executive of Baltimore County, where Sparrows Point lives, or Martin O'Malley. It feels from those on the outside looking in that the political leadership, for whatever reason, has decided to say it's not going to happen and we give up.
Well, I wouldn't say that because, I mean, I've had meetings with the governor in the governor's offices for over an hour. Mikulski helped set that up. Cardin was a part of it. Ruppersberger's been very helpful. The governor said, you know, he would do many things, you know, to help us attract the right owner to the plant, do things that would help that new owner and attract that new owner to the plant. And Kevin Kamenetz, I'm having regular meetings with him. It seems like once a month to inform him of what was going on. So in the auction process, we thought there would be a strategic steel maker that would bid. And up until the last day, I thought they would bid. And, you know, that didn't happen. It was kind of a surprise. It was kind of perplexing, you know, to most people because a lot of groundwork and legwork was done through due diligence and things of that nature that would have led you to believe that a certain strategic steel maker would have bid on us, which I don't want to use the names of the companies. In fact, there was another strategic steel maker touring the plant today. That those things can happen, and I really have assurances from the governor, from the county executive, from the federal politicians that they're 100% behind us and there are things that they can do to help us.
Thoughts from the panelists?
It's more complex than people believe today to sell manufacturing. I mean, it's a lot of, I think Joe made a good point, it's a lot of political discussions to take place that you really can't run out and report them to the press. Okay.
Well, let me turn to Charles Bradford as a steel industry analyst. I'm curious what do you think happens to cities like Baltimore, to Sparrows Point, to this plant? What's the future of it?
Well, I think the conversation you just had is delusional. There is no way you can save that plant unless the Nucor plant in Berkeley, South Carolina is closed, because that's what caused Sparrows Point to become non-competitive. When the Nucor plant was built in 1996, it had less than a third the number of people as Sparrows Point making the same product line. There wasn't room in the market for both. And that's what other people are looking at when they look at possibly investing in Sparrows Point. In fact, what Bethlehem Steel should have done in the late 90s, and we said so at the time, instead of building the new cold mill, instead of upgrading the hot mill, they should have put in a mini mill style plant like Nucor has in Berkeley, like they built elsewhere. And by the way, these plants were built with massive state incentives. Berkeley probably got $100 million in incentives. Other plants have gotten more. You can't compete with that technology if you have three times or more the people. And that's what the problem is.
So let's explore this for a minute. And I do want to get to our callers here. Albert and Mike, we're going to get to you at 410-319-8888. I interviewed, I just want to check when it was, the president and CEO of Nucor Steel back in 1996 when all this started occurring. And it is a non-union plant with less workers, getting paid less money, putting out as much steel.
Look, Charles Bradford and I know each other. You know, Chuck, it's Joe Rozelle.
Right.
So we've talked.
I assume so.
Yeah,
I thought I recognize your voice.
Yeah. We've talked many times over the last 15 years, especially at a meeting up in New York that happens every June. I mean, I kind of fundamentally disagree. I had to make a speech at that conference in 1999 saying that the rumors of the death of Sparrows Point were greatly exaggerated because they were telling me we were dead then when we built the new coal mill. The new coal mill wasn't a mistake. You know, the new coal mill is a better coal mill than most coal mills in the country. That's not a mistake. The problem was Bethlehem should have also built us a new plate mill. Instead, they went out and bought Lucan Steel for $840 million instead of building the new 160-inch mill in the plant for, say, $250 million and taking advantage of the number one caster that we had to be in the plate business, and Nucor would have stayed out of it and never built the Hereford, North Carolina plate mill. So there's more business around for us to do business. It's different. You know what I mean? It's a different paradigm. You know, we have the blast furnace. They have the electric arc furnace. But we've been in the tin business for decades, and there's no electric arc furnace producer that produces tin.
And that's one of the reasons why you had to stay with the blast furnace and not put in an electric furnace, which some other people have suggested. But the point is, except for that coal mill, the facilities at Sparrows Point are not competitive.
The blast furnace is competitive as the best blast furnaces in the country, and you know that. It's as good as number 7 or number 14 at U.S. Gary that U.S. Steel just spent about $300 million to $400 million to rebuild, 5 years ago?
But they have $80 pellet costs, and you've got pellet costs maybe twice as high.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is the same thing. We need a strategic steelmaker that lowers our cost of raw materials. I agree with you.
They can't legally do that. They go to jail. You cannot take... for example, in fact, the pellets out of Brazil at less than full market price. The Brazilian government wants the full tax payment.
So let me ask this.
We've had that argument before.
Well,
let me just say this, because I'm just curious before we come back to the two of you. I'm just curious what Mike Hartnett, sitting here, whose job is gone, and Mark Reuter, who's been covering this and wrote covering this a lot, what do you think when you hear this conversation going on, Mike?
Well, I'm not as up on some of the strategical stuff as Joe would be and or Mr. Bradford, but, you know, I have a more of a tendency to agree to the fact that I do believe that we're competitive, and even though we have less than some modernized mills, what we've done with these mills has been pretty amazing. And as Joe was saying before, where we did have some type of modernization put into them, I believe we would be just as competitive as any place.
And I want to chime in on what Mr. Bradford said.
Let me just go to Mark Reuter for a second. Mark, okay. I want to hear your thoughts on what you're hearing in this conversation.
Well, I'm hearing, Sparrows Point workers and union officials who I respect and wish I could agree with them, but the facts speak otherwise. The plant lost, and this is a fact because it's in the and that's what I deal with, $440 million in the last year, $440 million in 365 days. The strategic steelmaker has not materialized. The only person that materialized is a liquidator. And the writing is on the wall right now that the plant's future is not dim. It's not questionable. It's over. And that's what Mr. Bradford is saying. And I don't think wishful thinking and saying that the blast furnace may or may not be as competitive as others is going to really help steel workers or the city realize the sad but true fact, and that is that the plant has had many chances in the last 10 years since 1996 is a good place to start to modernize, to reduce its labor force, and it has not happened, and the good days are over.
The fact that the plant lost $440 million tells you it's not competitive. And that's not all iron ore cost.
What happened in the non-competitive situation is you were bought by a financial guy, Ira Renner, who was undercapitalized at the time that the market for raw materials was iron ore, $200 a ton, and coke, $500 a ton. Today, you know that coke is $350 a ton, and iron ore is $110 a ton. These things go up and down. In 2009, iron ore pellets and fines were as low as $50 a ton, lower than what you could get it in Minnesota. These things are cyclical. They go up and down. You know, but, we have a plan and developed a plan. I just need to say this. We've developed a plan that was signed off on by a strategic steelmaker doing his due diligence that we can get our costs down to, even buying ore at world market price, to make it competitive.
Well, I do want to kind
and
of...
And that's not fantasy.
Okay, I do want to push... We have to get a very short brief break for 1 minute and come right back. So, folks, and Larry, we're going to go to Mike and Larry when we come back. Get your calls near 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're here with Joe Rozell, president of the United Steelworkers Local 9477, financial secretary for that local. Mike Lewis is in the studio as well. Mike Hartnett works at Sparrows Point. All three men just lost their jobs at Sparrows Point. Mark Reuter wrote the book Making Steel and has been reporting on this issue here in Baltimore for the Baltimore Brew for a long time now. And Charles Bradford has joined us. Bradford has joined us. He's president of Bradford Research, a steel industry analyst. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Mike, you're on the air. Mike, you're on the air.
Spoke about the industrial age, and the fact is that that is really the crux of the problem. The industrial age was once the hope of many people that they would have a job in an industry that will last forever, only to find some other industry came in and took it over. For example, the horse and buggy. This discussion I find fascinating because it reminds me of the blind men who felt the elephant as they groped in the dark. And each one thought it was something else. Each was partly in the right, and all were in the wrong. Often what happens in these kind of disputes is people rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean and prate about an elephant not one of them has seen. What we have here is people discussing the various parts of what it means to have a steel industry and place blame on this one and that one and the other one, when the real fact is that the industrial age in America has come to an end. And in the beginning, before there even was mass manufacturing, people relied on themselves for the farms they worked on or cottage industries that they started. They never expected to have a job forever and to depend on management to always look out for them, and especially not to depend on the unions to look out for them. And so what people are finding now is their hopes were on something which was ephemeral, which was something which would not last forever, and it's time just to move on, get yourself a business that you can run yourself like the rest of us in our home-based businesses, and give up this dream because America's not coming back. They can't afford to compete
all right
with other countries, and people aren't even going to buy the steel if they could.
Mike, thank you for your thoughts. Let's talk about what Mike was saying, though, in a real way here. Are we just at the point in this country where steel... industries like steel are just not coming back? That we're at a place where if they do come back, they're going to come back with the idea of whittling down benefits, whittling down salaries, whittling down the union power, and hiring less workers to bring us more steel.
Well,
is that where we are?
Well, I don't think the demand for steel in this country has gone down.
That's not the issue, though.
The issue is that if we had all of our steel mills running, and I think Joe will agree with this, full out, we still would need to import steel. Mr. Bradford was talking about the tax the Brazilian government would put on raw materials. We're the only country that doesn't protect our own domestic industries. We're the dumping ground for the rest of the world. Our trade policies suck. You know, our trade imbalance has grown so dramatically in the last 30 years. And that's one of the issues. We're asked to compete with, in some cases, slave labor, child labor, in industries across the world. And we do nothing about it, Mark.
But here's the question I'd like to hear Charles Bradford's comment on this from an industry point of view, but also yours from a union point of view and yours from a journalistic point of view. I mean, if the steel industry in America, from my perspective looking at it, all the years covering it, and having a lot of family who have worked in it, is that the union has kind of lost power to industry. Industry says we're going to cut benefits. Cut benefits. Industry says we're going to take away the benefits of retired steelworkers. Take them away. No one strikes. No one steps up. No one fights it. And there's been constant pushing back. And so you're seeing the demise in many ways of this industry in America and the union that went to protect the workers in the beginning in the steel industry. So, I mean, it seems like we're at that kind of impasse now. Now, do you think I'm...
None of that, this is Chuck Bradford, is really the problem in my opinion. There was a technological change in the industry that allowed the mini mills with very low-cost plants, and I mean capital-cost plants, and low personnel to go from 15% of the market to 60% of the market.
And okay?
That's the problem. Imports are maybe 20%. They're not the key factor. It's the mini mills who came in and they pay their people more than the union pays people. They've got good benefits, profit sharing, you name it.
So how does the union respond to that?
Well, the market is 60% electric arc furnaces, I admit that. But the mini mills cannot still make all the different grades of steel that have to be made. We have to be moved up into the higher grades of steel. Tin, they don't make. Exposed automotive, they don't make. Electrical grain steels, they don't make.
Yes, they do.
No, they don't. AK is the only company that really sells electrical grain steels in the United States.
It
has any market. And they bring it up, you know, from other places.
No, it's made in the Butler Electric Furnace.
Well, what he knows is the highest grades of steel are not made normally in an electric arc furnace. We don't make tin from any electric arc furnace plant, and we have a tin mill. So we have to do it, and it's a different paradigm. That equipment, the blast furnace, has already been paid for. Yes, there's a lower cost of capital to get the electric arc furnace plant in there. But if we can lower our cost of raw materials, sometimes scrap goes up to $500 a ton and $600 a ton, which makes it bad for the electric arc furnace producers, and they become more expensive than us.
But sometimes scrap is 100 a ton, and it's 100 a ton just when iron ore is cheap. You're deluding yourself again.
Well, the iron ore hasn't been 100 a ton, you know, since about the early 2000s, and you know that.
Well, wait, listen, what I'm trying to say here, though, is, you know, when you have industry that has made these decisions about steelworkers' lives, which they've been doing. I mean, we have RG Steel gone bankrupt. The folks who own RG Steel are living well, and they're doing well, investing their money other places. You've just lost your job. 2,000 other workers, 19,909 other workers have lost their jobs in Sparrows Point. And who's standing up for the steelworkers who've lost their jobs?
And yet RG executives, the top 10 executives at RG Steel, a bankrupt company that they ran into the hole, asked for $2 million apiece to the bankruptcy judge in executive compensation bonuses.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
I don't think they got any of those bonuses because they didn't get the money they had to raise in the auction sale.
Good.
To require it. I don't think they got a penny, but I don't know that for a fact.
Well, I think the bankruptcy law should be changed because they're too beneficial to the corporations at the expense, you know, of the workers and the unsecured creditors, basically.
But look what happened when General Motors went bankrupt. The administration made sure that the employees came first, not the bondholders.
Well, I wish they would have done things for the steel industry over the years. I mean, there's $10 billion in subsidies to agriculture every year, and the steel industry in America gets nothing. And Sparrows Point, as late as 2008, had $3 billion in revenue.
We have to take a break for traffic. I know, Chuck, you have to run.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm sorry you have to leave us, but I know you have to do. We have to take a quick break for traffic. We're going to come back with our remaining guests. Continue this conversation. Go to Larry in Baltimore with this question and read Dwayne's email that came in over the transom.
We'll have to talk some more, Chuck.
Thank you, Charles Bradford, for being with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking about what's going on in Sparrows Point. As we get there, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. www.mecu.com. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. MECU.com or click on its banner at steinershow.org. Joe Rozelle is president of United Steelworkers Local 9477. Mike Hartnett has been there for 34 years.
36
years in the steel mill. He and his daughter, who's been working there for 7 years, as he said during the break, is a single mom with three kids, just bought a house, also laid off.
Correct.
From the steel mills. Mike Lewis is financial secretary for the local Mark Reuter, who wrote the book Making Steel, has been reporting on this issue for a long time for the Baltimore Brew. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to the phones. And Larry, you're on the air.
Oh, good evening.
Hi, Larry.
I'd like to say hello to my family. That's word that I did on your panel today. As a steelworker myself, 42 years, and we've been a family. I'm a second generation of steelworkers. And I want to say that I hold your optimism, brothers. I'm going to be optimistic. I was optimistic when Bethlehem Steel sold ISG. As you know, at that time, we were very profitable. I was optimistic when ISG sold to Metal, and we was profitable. I was optimistic when Metal went to Servistal. And at that point, the company, the country kind of went under with the problem with the country at that time. And then RG Steel took over, and since they went bankruptcy, but I'm still optimistic that we're going to get a buyer, so I'm going to hold on, and you guys just keep on working for us, keep on talking, keeping those positive vibes. And I got a suggestion. Maybe if the government would pay us TRA money like the 70s, they would stop dumping that steel in there from these foreign countries. They're putting these steel workers out of work. So keep on fighting for us, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
So I just let's get some little some thoughts in here before I go back to the phones at 410-319-8888 and read some emails that have come in. Mark, you've been really quiet, which is unusual for Mark Reuter.
Well, there's four people here.
Yeah,
so
but you're
I
one of them.
Give our five people.
And there were five, another four. And I just to talk about where your analysis a bit about what you've seen happen in the history of steel, where we are now, and where you think it's going.
Well, I'm very sad. You know, I hate to be the messenger here, and I'm sad about that because I'm wrote about the rise of steel. I respect steel workers. I think steel is important for the country strategically, militarily. I think that the bankruptcy code is terrible. We wrote about how lawyers get paid $1,100 an hour doing routine work in this bankruptcy case. So there's a lot of issues here. The saddest thing is that really Sparrow's Point, the handwriting was on the wall since the 80s, that it had to either innovate, it had to get electric arc furnaces, it had to have a strategic plan. And my book in 1988 ends off with that point. And instead, over the last 20 years, let me step back for a moment. When I did the work on the steel industry, which always had an aspect of being so big, having company towns, having all of this economic and political power, that was really a culture. We see the culture today with the family of Bethlehem Steel, RG Steel, here and on the radio listening in. And I came to the conclusion that the problems of the steel industry are not economic. They're not technological because we can easily buy this equipment. It's cultural. And the cultural problems has been the difficulty in a industry that was once absolutely pivotal in the nation's life, surrendering that power because that power is waning, and finding a new strategic way to modernize. There's been a couple industries that have done it. The railroad industry has managed to do it in this country. Incredible success story. Freight railroads, that is, very clear. But the traditional steelmakers and the USW, United Steelworkers, have not looked at objectively, has not done it. And in its place, the mini mills have taken over and have walloped them economically. And so it's sort of the case of the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs became extinct, and Sparrow's Point has now. And we're really dealing in a little bit of wonderland here. The bankruptcy court spoke last week. Sparrow's Point has been sold to a liquidator. All the union contracts are null and void. It's over. It's, you know, and the strategic steelmaker didn't come forward when he should have, according to people who thought he would come in. The last owner lost $440 million. It's a rough economy, and, you know, it's very difficult to say that. And some people, I think, have wanted to shoot the messenger. But the message is that things now are too late to change around. The ship has not turned around. It shouldn't have turned around 20 years ago.
And Joe Rozell, I'll let you all guys come in again. I mean, why do you think it's not too late? I mean, and I know you think that other people may buy the steel mill, you know, but many people are saying that is like a pipe dream, that this is not going to happen. This liquidator has one thing in mind, which is to make money on this plant.
The liquidators we've talked to now, they put in the record, the court record, they're willing to do nothing with the plant basically for 6 months while we look for a strategic steel buyer to buy the plant so that they could flip it and make money.
Let me correct you, Joe. I was at the hearing. You were not at the hearing. I was at the hearing. The U.S. steelworkers were not speaking at the hearing. They did not say that. They said that they would like to have jobs, and they said in the most vague way they would be interested in selling or dealing with this. They did not say 6 months. I don't know where that's come from. That might come from other information, but it's not in the court record. And they are liquidators. They need 6 months just to do environmental remediation, guys.
Well, here's what we're going to do. We've had talks with these people preliminarily, and this is what I'm saying has happened. He hasn't been involved in the talks that we've been involved with the Steelworkers Union and Hilco and what they're willing to do and not do.
I thought you said that you've never spoken to Hilco.
I didn't say I spoke to him. I said that the Steelworkers Union spoke to him.
So how do you know what Hilco has said
because
if you don't know?
Because my boss, Dave McCall, talked to them and told me what they said.
And what did they say?
I just told you before what they said, that they're willing to let the plant sit there for a while, not scrap it out while we have time to look for a strategic steel maker.
They did not say that, however, on the
court record. It was even put out in emails from the management of the plant saying the same thing.
It's not in the court record, and that's what prevails. The court record, what the judge says. I'm afraid to say this, but we're in a kind of never-never land with all of these rumors. That's the fact.
So what happens, though, to Mike Hartnett and all the other people who worked in that plant?
Well, just say
for the
this. We're going to have a meeting with Hilco, and we have to have one. We'll try to get a binding agreement that we can show Mr. Reuter that says that they give us time to look for a strategic steelmaker to buy the plant. Then maybe that'll convince him.
But the question I have is, let's say, even for argument's sake, that does happen, and before we have to cut to go to our next conversation here, I mean, if that does happen, what happens to the 2,000 men and women who are laid off? What happens to their benefits? What happens to their lives? And then you have to renegotiate a whole new contract because the contract is null and void.
Well, Mark,
right?
that's just the way it is today. The day, somebody had said it earlier, the day of the 30 years in a gold watch in a retirement working for a General Motors or a Bethlehem Steel, that day is over with. You're constantly getting a bridge built to the next phase. All right, so this is just a bridge that we're going to work on getting built to the next phase. As union representatives and as employees who put our lives into the work that we've done for the last three decades, we would be foolish to just turn around and walk away and not at least make a good faith effort to try to restore a valuable cog to the economy of the state of Maryland, of Baltimore County, and the ripple effect that it would have. We're not just going to roll over and play dead. We're going to put forth a good faith effort to try to save that plant. Will it be the same? Of course not. But we're still it's better than the alternative. You know, I sometimes go, there's a social responsibility that has to be looked at in this country. It's bigger than Sparrows Point plant. We just can't keep shutting down our facilities. Our manufacturing base is pretty much decimated. Nothing's coming in to replace it. And this is how we have situations in this country where we hear reports about jobless recoveries. The stockholders get paid. The men and women like Mike Hartnett, Joe Rozell, and myself, and the 2,000 other people, they lose their benefits. They lose their health care. In some cases, they lose their homes. And nothing comes in to replace it.
And finally, let's just say this, because we do have to break here. We have to go to our next segment. But I think that one of the questions is where the outrage is from the union. I mean, there's a lot of outrage in the community, which is why we're having the show, because we wanted the people to have in this union and the workers to have a voice about what's happened to them. But where's the outrage about what these companies are doing? I mean, I know you want another company to come in and take it over. But, I mean, part of it is the trust that we – put into these companies to actually take care of the workers in the facility.
We don't put trust in those companies. We put trust in trying to run these plants. But I look. I got to look to the future. The past, maybe I don't like Ira Renner. You want me to sit here and go on a rant about Ira Renner? I don't know what good it does me. I mean, I got to deal with the management's in the plant today so I can go on a tour tomorrow with somebody who's interested in buying the plant. I can't make everybody mad at me. You know what I mean? I teach negotiation, right? It's hard on the problem and soft on the people, whether I like those people or the things that they did or not. I'm looking out for my members. I'm looking for fighting for to make sure that we have a future and we can make this thing work. If Obama would step up his game, for instance, and we would rebuild the infrastructure of the country, you would need a whole lot more steel than we have today. And of that infrastructure rebuilding, 10% of it would be steel. And this, say, it's $3 trillion over the next 20 years. That's $300 billion worth of steel that Sparrows Point could participate in. And an electric arc furnace is one technology. A blast furnace that we already have there is another technology. If we made enough money over time, yeah, we could go and switch to electric arc furnaces. You couldn't do that when you have a 10,000-ton blast furnace that sits there every day that's as efficient as it is. You can only do that after you've made enough money to say, let's expand the plant. Sparrows Point should be expanded. And if I expanded it beyond the $3 million and $4 million we could do under the current configuration to $5 million or $6 million, I'd have electric arc furnaces in there to do it. There's no doubt about that.
So, gentlemen, we'll come back to this. We're going to follow what's happening here at Sparrows Point. We're going to follow the lives of the men and women who came out of this steel mill who lost their jobs and tell their stories as well as we go through this. And ask Martin O'Malley and others, Kevin Cabinets, hold their feet to the fire a little bit and find out exactly what they're going to do about this. And I want to wish you all the luck in the world, Mike Harnett, Mike Lewis, as you get laid off, and hope that you get through this, whatever comes out the other side, including you, Joe Rozelle.
Thank you.
I appreciate all of you for coming in today and being part of this, and Mark Reuter for being dogged in covering this issue about Sparrows Point for the Baltimore Brew. Good to have you all here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. Good luck.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
To all of us.
Yeah.
All of us. We're going to take a short break and come right back, and we're going to take a look at this new TV series come out that many people are very upset about called Stars Earn Stripes. Reality TV, is it really backing our men and women overseas who are doing these, who are in the armed services, or is it another kind of these mock games making war as entertainment? We'll be right back with all that. Stay with us.